For South Carolina Public Radio, I'm Bradley Fuller. American architect Frank Lloyd Wright once advised, "Never miss the idea that music and architecture belong together. They are practically one." For the crowd in attendance at the 6th Music at Milford, held on September 23rd in Pinewood, South Carolina, Wright's advice was easy enough to take to heart. The event, presented by the Classical American Homes Preservation Trust, was one of three concerts given in historic houses along the East Coast as part of a series entitled The Classical Ideal, Music and Architecture in Harmony. I had the chance to speak with Robert DeMaine, music director of the series and principal cellist of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, about how he began performing in these historic settings.
It was through a pianist friend of mine, Jim Wilhelmson, who used to come on vacation here and would play an occasional concert here, sometimes with Christina Clark, his friend, who is married to Emery Clark, who was an heir to the home. So the home has been in the family for quite a few generations. So that's how it all started. And then Christina approached me a few summers ago about becoming an artistic director for a series. And we would go summer by summer and see how it went. And it's now 4 years later, and here we are, and it's going stronger than ever. And I try to mix it up and keep it different every year.
Robert may vary the programs from year to year, but he keeps consistent his search for music that is appropriate for the performance venues.
The pieces that I've generally programmed have been designed to be performed in spaces like this, and they sound best, arguably, in a space like Milford or Edgewater or in Airmount, which is a little bit bound by the fact that it's a forte piano. And that was interesting because I had to approach the cello part as a Baroque cello without the end pin, and tuning down to A equals, 415 hertz. And that was interesting, something I hadn't done in about 20 years when I used to play quite a bit of Baroque cello and continuo playing. And I'm glad that earlier training stood me in good stead for this particular concert. I played two Beethoven sonatas down there with forte piano. And what was neat about that concert was that everything that was involved in the concert was made or created or reduced in size or whatever within 10 years. Actually, within 7 years. The Beethoven sonatas that I had played were written in 1796 or 95 for his friend and patron, who was a very, very good amateur cellist. And my bow was made around 1800. The house was made in the late 1700s. And the cello that I was playing on, the General Kidd Stradivari from the LA Philharmonic, was cut down in size in London in 1800, right around the time that the Broadwood pianoforte was being made in London. So within a couple of years of that. So by Edward Dodd, that's who did the diminution of the size of the cello. I can't imagine how large the cello was before.
Using period instruments and performing within the walls of a centuries-old space provides musicians like Robert with a unique opportunity to better understand the historical context in which certain works of classical music were written. But it doesn't necessarily answer all questions about how to perform a piece in a historically authentic manner. Robert pointed out that there is room for debate when it comes to many performance practices, such as the use of vibrato.
You know, one will say, well, Leopold Mozart said we shouldn't play with a constant palsy. Yet Francesco Gimignani is quoted as saying we should use it as often as possible. Yet he is the least often quoted out of all the early music specialists. And it's odd to me because he is perhaps the much more distinguished violin teacher, pedagogue, and violinist of the time.
For Robert, though, the solution to such performance dilemmas is really quite simple.
I think a lot of it boils down to taste, and I think you have to be honest with yourself first. If you can't convince yourself, you're not going to convince your listener. If you make yourself weep, you're going to make others weep.
Robert shared more than his words about moving people. He also shared one of his compositions, Finisterre, an etude caprice for cello. The work, meant to be both fun and challenging, incorporates influences as diverse as Robert's French heritage and his interest in the music of Dave Brubeck. Here is Robert performing his work. Cellist Robert Demain performing his Finisterre, an etude caprice for solo cello, at the September 23rd concert at Milford in Pinewood, South Carolina. Milford was host not only to the concert, but also to an open rehearsal of the Sumter High School Orchestra and a lecture by Dr. Nick Butler, a South Carolina historian and musicologist. Nick, who has written a book on the St. Cecilia Society and patronage of concert music in Charleston in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, spoke on the relationship of art, music, and culture in the antebellum era, explaining how the aesthetics of both classicism and romanticism were influential at this time.
Classicism in architecture is fairly easy to grasp visually because it's an aesthetic about clean lines and formal structure that's very easy to perceive, the structure, and say the rhythm of the columns on the portico that we're sitting on, for example, very easily perceived visually. And think about clean lines and very sparse ornamentation and decoration. We take all those things with our eyes, and we forget that it translates fairly easily to music and taking those same qualities in through our ears. We listen to a very clearly defined melody with sparse ornamentation in classical music, for example, a late Haydn symphony. Think about a very clear relationship between the supporting harmony, whether it be an orchestra or the piano, and the soloist, whether it's a violin or a voice or a chorus of violins. So there are a lot of characteristics, aesthetic traits that have oral or audible equivalents. And so those are fun to talk about and to make comparisons. And a place like this is, you know, an ideal place to do that.
Indeed, Nick went on to elaborate about a type of architecture underlying classical era music.
The form that we call sonata form today, as deployed in a symphony or in a piano sonata, a solo instrument sonata, is something that wasn't invented by one person and it didn't coalesce in a short period of time. It took generations, but by the time we get to the end of the 19th century, by the time we get to Haydn and Mozart and very early Beethoven, it is a formal structure people are familiar with, and it's something that is kind of expected for composers to embrace. But at the same time, it's not something the audience would have necessarily listened attentively for. So in Mozart's time, in Haydn's time, with the exception of a few musical geeks sitting in the front row, most people are not aware of this architectural kind of style, this architectural form being deployed in this sonata movement or symphony movement for them. They're listening to it and enjoying it, but it's going on in the background, because it's a conservative style that's not meant to attract attention to itself. It is something that is supposed to complement a social occasion, like, you know, the Esterházy family getting together, or a rich club or family getting together, or friends and family getting together. And so the musical forms are not trying to attract attention to themselves. So following a prescribed pattern and meeting expectations and not surprising people was part of the aesthetic. And when you start talking about surprising people with your composition and saying, look what I can do, then you're attracting attention to yourself. And in the aesthetics of the early 19th century, you know, the turn of the 19th century, that would have been a way of drawing unnecessary attention to yourself and kind of taking away from the general spirit of the event. So in the conservative world of classical era music, turn of the 19th century, that would have been a faux pas. But later on, romanticism became about a way of saying, look what I can do, and I'm different, and I'm special, and I bet you didn't think I was going to do this. And people embrace that. So it's a romanticism, a totally separate kind of musical phenomenon, but it's easier to understand that when you juxtapose it with classicism.
Just as juxtaposition can serve to illuminate the specific qualities of a work of music, it can also highlight the architectural features of a space. The main house at Milford, finished in 1841 for John and Susan Manning, is an imposing monumental edifice, one of the most striking examples of Greek Revival domestic architecture in the United States. Nick pointed out that this classical styling worked to underscore the Mannings' education, taste, and familiarity with antiquity, communicating permanence and stability at a time when South Carolina society was becoming more conservative and settled. But standing in contrast to the classical order of the house, and helping to bring that order into sharper focus, is a small structure on the grounds known as a folly.
An architectural folly is it is kind of a romantic, whimsical kind of thing. It's an piece of architecture that doesn't really serve any purpose, except it's aesthetically pleasing. But it serves as a great foil for a contrasting style. So, for example, here at Milford, we have this wonderfully austere Greek Revival classical structure, but then there is a Gothic Revival folly just off in the distance, and which you can see from the house. And that's kind of a purposeful structure, because seeing that contrast between them creates a sense of appreciation one for the other. So, you know, the palate gets tired of eating the same thing, and the ear grows tired of hearing the same thing, and the eye grows weary of seeing repetition. So having a contrast is very useful in setting off the aesthetic that you're trying to embrace.
The usefulness of contrast as a palate cleanser for the senses is an important factor in the selection of pieces for a well-balanced concert program. In the case of the Classical Ideal, a program that included works as diverse as Robert Demain's Étude Caprice, featured earlier, and François Couperin's Le Tic Toc Choc, performed here by pianist Simon Adarès. That was Simon Adarès, piano, performing François Couperin's Le Tic Toc Choc. In addition to performing these divergent solo selections, Simon and Robert also joined together for two works, compositions in which juxtaposition once again played a crucial role, the interactions between piano and cello creating a compelling dialogue, Camille Saint-Saëns' Cello Sonata No. 1, Opus 32, and Sergei Rachmaninoff's Sonata in G Minor for Cello and Piano, Opus 19. Here, Simon and Robert perform the second and third movements of Rachmaninoff's Sonata. ¶¶
Thank you.
That was the second and third movements of Sergei Rachmaninoff's Sonata for Cello and Piano in G minor, Opus 19, performed by pianist Simon Adarès and cellist Robert Demain in a live concert given in the Double Parlor of Milford in Pinewood, South Carolina. The concert was part of The Classical Ideal, Music and Architecture in Harmony, a series presented by the Classical American Homes Preservation Trust. For South Carolina Public Radio, I'm Bradley Fuller.